So we are recording here. Let me welcome everybody here. Thank you for attending the 2020 Digital Sunstone Digital Symposium, Session 275, titled LDS Artists of Color, an Introduction. The audio from this session will be available for purchase at sunstone.org after the symposium. The video recording of this session will be available in the Whova app for the remainder of 2020. At Sunstone, we are making it a goal to build a community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our tagline is, there is more than one way to Mormon. We invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given space to be better understood. Please support us in our mission by making a donation and subscribing at sunstone.org. About this presentation, the future of Mormon art, like the future of the Mormon people, lies with its global, diverse, and multicultural population. This session highlights the work of five women of color whose work is transforming the landscape of Mormon visual art. All these artists invite and challenge questions about culture and faith. View and shop the work of the featured artists. Marlena Marie Wilding is at marlenawilding.com, and I'll post a link in the chat so that you guys don't have to write these down. Esther Hiilani Kandari is at hiilanifinearts.com. Michelle Franzoni Thorley is at florafamiliar.com. Kwani Wilder is at KalaniWilder.com. Kalani Tonga is at facebook.com/Kalani.a.Tonga. Andy Pitcher Davis is a conceptual artist, photographer, and Mormon art critic. I'll let her introduce herself. She's also the art editor for Dialogue Journal. Kalani Tonga is an artist, activist, and writer who spends her energy keeping her adorable but adventurous five runts alive. She has been featured in A Book of Mormons, Latter-day Saints on a Modern Day Zion, and the blog FeministMormonHousewives.org. I don't think Kwani's here. Marlena Wilding graduated with a BA in Visual Arts from BYU. She lives in Seattle, Washington, with her loving husband and two toddlers. Michelle Franzoni Thorley creates art that focuses on the ancestral power to heal. She's a self-taught artist who has claimed power through embracing her Mexican-American heritage and visual and her experiences as an LDS woman artist. Her work has been displayed at the Written Vision Gallery, LDS Church History Museum, and the Springville Museum of Art. She spoke at the Latter-day Saint Arts in New York City in June 2019 about diversity in LDS art. Esther Hiilani Kandari was born to a mixed Asian American family and raised on the beautiful eastern shore of Oahu, Hawaii. As an artist, her work reflects this rich multicultural upbringing and often draws upon Polynesian symbols and cultural ideologies. She has a BFA from BYU Hawaii, an MFA from Liberty University, has studied at the New York Academy of Art, and interned with Joseph Bricky. Margaret Blair Young is an American writer and president of the Congo Rising Corporation, a foundation focused on initiatives in the Democratic Republic of Congo, including film. She taught creative writing for 34 years at Brigham Young University in the United States. She's published 6 novels and 2 short story collections, as well as numerous essays. I want to give you guys, some of these are a little bit long, so I'm going to cut these a little bit short, except for I do want to just mention that she was one of the producers for the film Heart of Africa and has an upcoming film, and I'll let her share that. So I'm going to now give the floor to our speakers and take it away, Andy.
Even if you're not really well-mannered, you can make a habit of being civil.
I couldn't get out to see my friend.
And she's able to match the right skirt with the right sweater.
She may be a communist.
Helen has trained herself to know what she's going to do.
Communist.
I'm going to lunch with Mother.
Couldn't take part in PTA activities.
Oh, I'm so happy. I could be a model.
You couldn't help interrupting, could you?
I don't know.
You added nothing to that conversation.
All right, cover girl!
It's a little late for tears, isn't it, Barbara?
And sometimes, I don't know.
Now it's a little late, isn't it?
I don't take dictation. I pushed the button on the Xerox 914.
Miss Jones.
Sometimes my boss asks me which is the original, and sometimes I don't know.
Dave has it all to himself. When he was gone, I was practically a prisoner in my own home. But that's all changed now.
That has all changed now. This is a piece by Marlena Wilding that I love, both the artwork and the sound art. And Marlena is, I hope she was able to hear that. I want to introduce five of the strongest, most amazing women I know. And really, when I set out originally to focus on artists of color, I didn't know that they'd all be women, but of course they are. And I have, of course, we have Esther Candari, who's put together something that's really amazing. I have Michelle Franzoni Thorley. I have with me Kalani Tonga. I have with me also Kwani Povey-Winder and Marlena Wilding, who will pop back in as soon as she has her kids set away. I want you guys to know, and then I'm going to stop talking, is that you are my backbone and you are my spine. And as that piece ends and it says, it's a little late for tears, Barbara, all that has changed now. Well, there's not a Barbara among you. And maybe Barbara's crying because she's not as strong and as amazing and as diverse as you five are. And I want to introduce this session and kick it off with another LDS woman of color who sings a song, and it is, we'll go ahead and go into Kiala Settle's This Is Me, only I want you to think this is she. And this is devoted to you guys, and then you guys take it away.
They say, it's been a watch of broken parts. I've learned to be ashamed of all my scars. Run away, they say. Thank you.
Esther, take it away. I want you guys to meet the artist up close. Tell us about this project, Esther.
So the video, man, I'm like tearing up a little. That song always gets to me. Andy reached out to me just a couple weeks ago with this idea of putting this together, and we're trying to figure out how to make it work with everybody, you know, in different time zones and, you know, different schedules. And so we decided to pre-record some content and, just kind of streamline that. And then we'll have some discussion afterwards. But we'll start off with just a few images of the work from the artists that are represented in this session, and then go into some curated content of discussion of topic points related to our work and our life experiences and how those all interact. So really, it explains itself. So I guess we can turn over to that now.
Take it away, Mike.
Something I set out or ever envisioned myself being an artist. I grew up drawing and always doing art as long as I can remember. My mom said I was holding a pencil from the time I could hold anything in my hand. And it wasn't until my dad passed away that art became my solace and kind of helped pull me a little bit out of the hole, the dark hole that I was in. And two things happened. One was a voice inside of me that said, if this is where you go to find comfort, to find peace, to make sense of things, then maybe that's where you need to be and where you need to be headed. So the second part was a reprimand of some kind. It was a chastisement saying that you have not been developing this great talent that I've given you, that you have been playing around with it, and yeah, you've used it, but you haven't used it, and you haven't used it for me. And I just felt this responsibility just kind of rest on my shoulders, and I didn't know where I was going to go, what I was going to do with my art, but I felt that there was a reason, and I have since felt over and over again little confirmations that tell me I'm on the right path, and gentle corrections. I sat at a seminar one time and realized that I was not doing God's work with my art, and that needed to change. But you would feel a spirit because they were created with a spirit. And so I did these series of paintings, and the final one that I created was a painting called My Faith. And that was the first time I feel like I really connected my religion, my ancestry, to this one painting, and it has touched many people and brought people to tears. And that's what something I really enjoy about the creative process and about being an artist and about what I do and I've started to do as art, is that I paint the painting, but I don't finish the painting. It's the viewer that finishes the painting. And there's a reason why I am an LDS artist, a Latter-day Saint artist. There's a reason why I have the heritage that I do, that I'm Native American. There's a reason why I grew up in Idaho and not on our that I attended BYU Idaho, that has one of the most traditional art programs, and yet I didn't go to college wanting to be an artist, and yet that's how I ended up at. Had I gone to any other university, I'm not sure that would have happened, and I definitely would not have received the traditional training that I am so grateful for. Had I attended a different university. There's all these things, these guidances, these tender mercies that I was given that led me to where I am now. And it's all come line upon line. It's been incredible to see the response, to see the people that have been touched. The Native people, especially, that come to me and see the light and see that my paintings are different because, and I know it's because I paint them with the spirit. My paintings are about hope and about light and faith. They're about the person and about the light that they have and capturing them and their soul and their spirit, not just their regalia and not just, oh, that's a cool picture. I use those tools. I use those, the lighting, the poses, all of that design to support what I'm trying to say and to lift and enlighten.
I'm a perfectionist, and you know, the past decade has been kind of a slow letting go of that, because you can't really be a perfectionist and have four babies in diapers and, you know, be the only one in charge of them, because it's just, it's impossible to do things perfectly. But one of the things that I decided really early on with my art was that, I was going to go into everything with the assumption that there were no mistakes. And, you know, I paint a lot of traditional Polynesian designs and patterns. And so when I went into it, I kind of felt like I was able to connect with some of my ancestors in that way, because I know for a fact that there have been ancestors in my past that have probably drawn those exact same designs, and probably done the exact same, you know, motions that I was doing and things like that. And I decided that if I made a movement that changed my painting in a way that I wasn't happy with, rather than look at it as a mistake, I decided to see it as maybe that was my ancestors telling me to do something different, or maybe that was muscle memory from generations past showing me how to do it in a different way. And I think in that way, my art has helped me to kind of gain an appreciation for and to look for ways in my life that maybe those who came before me are influencing me in ways that I hadn't seen before.
So growing up mixed race, it kind of felt like a constant identity crisis. I had this sort of epiphany when I was about 13. I went to my mom and I said, you know, I understand why I don't have friends. I think like a white homeschooled American. So I was homeschooled growing up by my mother, who's white. But I have the work ethic of an Asian, and I have the cultural practices and kind of social cues of a Polynesian because I grew up in Hawaii, and then I'm Mormon. Like, there's literally no circle that I fit into. And it was funny, even though it was kind of this sort of this depressing moment, it was also a very empowering moment because I realized I had been placed in a unique spot in this life to be a bridge between a lot of those different kind of circles and demographics of individuals. And the older I've gotten, the more I've seen that my ability to code shift, my ability to take pieces of visual and cultural and written language from so many different circles and bring them into one space that a lot of people can relate to, that in many ways I feel like it's my superpower as an artist. It allows me to build bridges. It allows me to open people's eyes and help people to see commonalities. And that's something that I feel very personally called to do as an artist. And for me, it's been a very healing experience because it's helped me to better understand my place in the world. It's given me opportunities to research the different cultures that I come from, whether that's my Asian American ancestry or the Polynesian culture that I was raised in, and really connect with and build roots into those and understand kind of the conflicts that exist between those, you know, understanding the disparity between my immigrant heritage from my father's side versus my pilgrim heritage from my mother's side, and knowing that, you know, mistakes were made on both sides, and seeing how in many ways I'm a manifestation of healing between many races, between many different groups, and trying to use my art to express that to others that haven't found that space yet for themselves personally. It's just been a very grounding experience for me.
Hi, my name is Michelle Franzoni Thorley. I am a Mexican-American artist. I am also a mother to three young children, and I am also someone who lives with chronic pain. I have a spinal injury from a car accident when I was in my 20s. And I think all of these themes show up in my work. I use a lot of symbolism in my work with plants, and then also flora, so the plants, different kinds of leaves and flowers. And then also I use a lot of traditional symbolism from Mexico and Latin America. And then I draw a lot of symbolism from my ancestry, whether that's my Swedish ancestry or my Italian ancestry. I think a lot of Latinos in general, we come from mixed ancestry. So we're usually a mix of European, Indigenous American, and African. And I think it, for many years, it's been hard for us to find where we fit because we don't fit nicely into the checked census boxes. And so I use a lot of symbolism from each of those places to tell a story of my life, a story of mixed ancestry, of my experiences.
The direction that I've headed with my life and in my art is there's this Native side to me, and then there's this traditional art side that where I went to a traditional school and painting for life, and I wanted to marry them. So there's these symbols and all these things that are in our pottery that I think, and I am trying to work into my art to further reinforce the light and the spirit and the story that I want to tell and want to capture.
Because they allow you to build layers into your work. They allow you to bring in pieces that will resonate with lots of different demographics and might mean something completely different to different people seeing a piece. And so in many ways, it allows you to make individual pieces of artwork kind of like a Swiss Army knife. And just all these different elements that might kind of grab people's attention and pull them in and then bring them together in a space where they have to ask questions and where they have to ask themselves what those symbols mean to them. And I recognize that sometimes I create symbols that might mean something to someone else. But my goal is if I can get people to ask questions, then my symbols are being effective. And I also think it's important to make sure that the symbols, while they might have multiple layers, are things that are still familiar to people. Something that gives them a sense of belonging within the piece, a sense of resonating with the piece. And personally, I've always taken... that he used symbols in his work. And obviously, if you look at the New Testament, his work was through kind of written, not really so much written as in spoken imagery, but it's not a far leap for me to then translate that to visual imagery. And I did a recent kind of little study for an article that I was writing, looking at trends of how Christ used imagery within his parables and other stories that he would tell. And a few things that I picked up on were that he used things that were familiar to people, but he always used them with a little bit of a twist. It was, let's take something that you see in an everyday life, whether that be a fig tree or wheat or Samaritans, you know, addressing race issues within his time, and then put it in such a way that just makes you a little bit uncomfortable or just question just a little bit and ask yourself where you fall into this imagery. And that's something that I try to do with my work.
Symbolism is throughout my work always. I enjoy symbolism because, you know, somebody could look at my artwork and see, oh, that's visually appealing. You know, I like the way that looks. And then someone else who understands the symbolism can have like a deeper meaning. And that's something that me and that person can share, if that makes sense. And it means more to them. And then someone else would catch something else that I put in there, and it's even more personal. I think it's also kind of, you know, the scripture always kind of rung in my mind, you know, don't cast pearls before swine. Obviously, people aren't swine. But the idea of it is that there's something that's really personal to you, something that, you know, you're careful about sharing because you're not ready to kind of expose that. You can kind of say a lot of things, like it's like your diary. You can kind of expose a lot of things that are really sensitive and personal, and that those who don't necessarily care or want to dive deep, they can just appreciate it for what it is, you know, visually. But those who kind of understand some of the symbolism behind that can be more connected, and so they can have like a deeper, you know, connection to that work.
Been super fascinated with patterns ever since I was a young kid. You can ask my mom. I was always drawing patterns. I was always arranging things into patterns. I have a possibly unhealthy obsession with organizing things. I don't know, just something about seeing things in patterns, just it's satisfying to me. But at the same time, patterns can be very limiting, and that's something that I have experienced a lot as a woman, and especially in a woman in a church that tends to be fairly, or at least historically, has been fairly rigid with gender roles. Something that I talk a lot about in both my written work and my artistic work is the delineation between church culture and church doctrine, and really not even church doctrine, but the doctrine of Christ, what our Savior wants us to do. And I feel like it's really pivotal in how I decide to develop paintings. And how I decided to develop what narratives I want to focus on. And something that I've increasingly tried to stop and ask myself whenever I sit down and decide, what do I want to paint, is I ask myself, why am I doing this? Why do I arrange the figures like this? Why do I select this person as a model? Why do I choose to paint this story? Why do I paint it this way? And really ask myself, how much of this story that I'm telling is my personal testimony, is you know, firsthand or, you know, primary sources from the scriptures, or if it's, you know, a historical church figure, you know, as primary sources as I can get about them, and how much of it is just regurgitated perceptions of who this person or this concept should be. And I always surprise myself with how often I'm sort of just reverting to things because I've seen them before, not because there's actual fact or truth or even strong emotions grounding these concepts that I am trying to communicate. And I found as I continue to do that throughout my work, it's made my work more and more meaningful, both to me and to other people, because it begins to ask genuine and unique questions to the viewer, and it starts to fill in holes that exist within the visual culture of the church. With everything that's going on in the world right now, and with the church becoming increasingly global, and with so many complex questions that all of us have to address, it's really important for us to ask ourselves that. Are we doing this out of habit, or are we doing it because we believe it and because it's right? And I think that question can apply to so many things, but I think it's especially important to ask yourself of that when you are creating art, and especially when you're creating spiritual or religious art that may influence the religiosity and spirituality of someone else or even an entire demographic.
So I came to the art world a little later than most. I think I was about 40 when I first started really painting. And I had been a single mom to 5 kids, and I had 4 of those kids within a 2-year period. And then my husband went to prison, so he was gone as soon as, like, right before my youngest was born. So, you know, I had this, like, 6-year span of just changing diapers and going to multiple jobs and trying to keep all of these kids alive and safe and healthy. And when I got here to Utah and I suddenly had help and I suddenly wasn't the only one in charge, I feel like I just had this huge, it was like I was vomiting out all of the creativity that had been stored up for years and years and years while I had been doing all of this mothering. And so in terms of how being a mother has affected my art, I'm super grateful for my kids and for the way that they have affected my life. They're amazing. And I'm also super grateful for having help and not having to be the only one in charge anymore, and for the freedom that that has given me to be creative and explore that side of my life.
Having my daughters in my life has only made my art better. It's made it deeper and stronger, and I've seen my talents accelerated, that I learn things quicker. I'm able to master things that I work on in less time than I have before. It's really incredible to me and such a blessing and a tender mercy that my talents and abilities have been strengthened because of the things that I was worried about but felt that were right, like starting a family, becoming an artist. All these things are for good. And when I follow that good and when I follow that light, I see that I'm able to be used as a vessel to bless others and to share that light. My testimony is through art.
I would say, you know, in a way, motherhood has really opened my eyes to this world a pretty compassionate and a person with empathy, but having children has helped open my eyes a little bit more as what it means to love. And, you know, my concepts, what I choose to paint and to make have kind of grown because of that. And, you know, it's really interesting because I feel like, you know, though I have been able to expand my mind and to grow a lot as a mom, and so therefore I have all these other ideas that I want to create with, it also is challenging being a mom who's an artist, because finding their time to actually create those things can be challenging. Because, I mean, right now my kids are young, so my daughter's one and my son's three. In a three-bedroom apartment, there are certain materials that I do not use.
Like I mentioned before, I have three young children. My oldest daughter is autistic and awesome. And then I have a son and then a younger daughter. Being a mother artist is, I don't know what to say about it. It's real hard. Like, especially when you're dealing with an art medium that's not easy to be around with children, such as oil painting, the solvents and the paint themselves is hard. So you actually need a designated space to feel like you can, you know, leave work out or whatever. And I haven't always had that. And that is really difficult. And then just the time demands, like it is, you know, especially in the times of COVID and homeschooling, it has been so hard to carve out time for myself to work. And then the emotional needs of my children too. And I feel like lately someone always needs something from me. And so there's never time to work. And then when I do work, sometimes I feel guilty because there's always a price. I don't know those women who have it all and can do it all. Like, if I work, that means the laundry is not put away. If I choose to paint, then the kitchen's not getting clean. And my kids are getting older and helping out more, and my husband helps out a lot. But a lot of the duties fall on me, so I think it's talking to my family and letting them know that we're a team and that they have to do some of the chores that everyone thinks that just I'm the magical.
The advice I would give my younger self and younger artists, but first I will go to myself, is you know, when I studied at BYU, I was the only black student in the art department at the time, and I was very insecure, sensitive, and, you know, there are things that I kind of, how I took the response of others who saw my work because it was different, because I was kind of playing and toying with my black experience, which is something that a lot of my colleagues and teachers couldn't quite understand. And so, you know, I kind of took a lot of things personally, and I remember I had an incident where, you know, I made a piece of work that was really special to me, and I had a professor that kind of, you know, told me that it wasn't, you know, it had an opinion about it, and because of that opinion, I just didn't think I was that good. And, you know, after that, when I graduated, and that's also a reason why I didn't get my BFA, I just got my BA, and I decided, oh, okay, I should teach art. So after that, I didn't really make anything for a very, very long time, even though ever since I was a little girl, I always wanted to be an artist. Ever since I could remember, I've been drawing. That's all I wanted to do. I've never applied to anything else. I just, you know, when I went to college, I just wanted to be an art. And I chose to listen to that and not listen to my inner voice that told me that if I wanted to do it, that I could be it. And because of that, again, I don't have a lot of work. And that's one thing that I would, you know, advise anyone who's interested in being an artist, that listen to your inner voice. And if it's something that you love and it's in your soul and that you want to do, you are an artist. You are.
I think the biggest piece of advice that I would give is that effort is everything. One of the most frustrating things that people have said to me over the years is, oh, you're so naturally gifted. And the reason that that always frustrated me was for the same reason that I hate it when people would just compliment me on my looks. I didn't have anything to do with the way that I look. That was blessings of good genetics. And if my skill as an artist is just natural talent, then it gives no credit for the hard work that I've put into it. It's precedent that not just anybody can do this, that, you know, you have to be special to be an artist. And I think that perception has limited so many people that could have contributed great and important things to the visual dialogue of our culture. And I've seen how I was limited by those perceptions. And there was a long time when I didn't really see myself as a professional artist. Like, I was studying art in school, but I figured, you know, I was going to go into art therapy or art education or something like that. And I just felt like there was too big of a leap between where my skills were and where I felt like my skills needed to be considered a quote-unquote professional artist. But the sooner you start telling yourself that you are and that you are going to be a professional artist, the sooner that you'll start to see those dreams actualized. And so that would be my piece of advice, is see yourself as a professional. And at the very least, see yourself as someone that is working to become a professional, and be willing to make the sacrifices that it takes to get there. Because if you do, you will.
One of the questions was, what would I say to my younger self or younger artists? And I would say to any other, especially artists of color, that don't think that lack of privilege or opportunity, don't think that can keep you from following your dreams. I know I didn't have the opportunity to go to school to study art. I had to learn a lot of things I learned on YouTube and reached out on social media to other professional artists who gratefully took me seriously and offered to help me. So I wish I could have said to my younger self, don't give up just because you aren't doing things the same way that others have done them. Like, it's still possible to tell your stories, and we need your stories. I think that's one of the most exciting thing about what's happening right now, how people are more open to talking about race, how people are searching into their family histories, their own personal histories. And I think with social media as well, we are hearing stories and histories that have never been told before. And I think that's what's most exciting about art as well, especially within the LDS Church, that as we have more artists of color, more women artists sharing our stories from our own perspectives, one of the biggest things on Instagram right now is the hashtag Own Voices. So books and media written by people of color in their own voices. And I think that's so important for the visual arts as well, is that that we are having an opportunity to tell our own stories and our own voices. And I think that's just so exciting, because I'm so excited to learn about all the things and hear all the stories that I've never heard before. And also with social media, like I said, there's so many resources out there that even if you didn't go to school and you don't have professional training, if it's a dream of yours, pursue it and try to do your best. I know that it won't be easy, but I hope that I'm somewhat of proof that it is possible. And I'm just so grateful for all the opportunities I've been given to share my art, to share my perspective, and to share my family history, because I know it's important. Thanks.
You know, first of all, amazing. And to have you guys in collaboration, one thing I need to explain, and this is something I find that people assume about us as artists, people assume we all know each other, that we all hang out together. By a raise of hands, who's not met everybody who's on this session before in real life? You see that? None of us. We have this community, and it is one of the reasons why I invited Margaret, is because I want to talk about how we create spaces to come together. I'm going to say two things, and I want to move on to exactly why it is that I chose this word patterns. And actually, you guys chose it. It just shows up in your work. I think the future of Mormonism lay in the combination and the coming together of the right and the left. And I don't mean politically. I mean the left brain of art and the right brain of scholarship coming together, the logical and historical, along with the creative and the making. And this is what we do. We collaborate with the creator. Of course, the future of art in general is diversity. And not only are these women, are you guys diverse, you know who you are. You're put together, you know why you make art. And it is in collaboration, I think, so often with your children, with the Savior, with your faith, with your, you know, all sorts of things. And so it is like, it's like participating in all those levels of art making. I want to, I have a little surprise because I've chosen a piece of art by each one of you. And I'm wondering if I can ask you where you see the patterns in this, or what, if you can tell me about what really motivated you. This is really me showing that I really love this art. So let's see if we can get Michelle up first. Is there a slide for Michelle? Michelle knows which painting I love, huh? Unmute yourself, Michelle.
Hi.
Let's see if we can get it. Mike? It's somewhere.
What painting do you want?
The first painting, Michelle's ancestry. Ancestress. It's coming. While that's coming, Michelle, do you want to go ahead and start talking about making this painting, and we can look at it when it comes up?
So this painting is actually one of three. The other two are yet to be created, but they all go together because there are certain times in my life I didn't grow up feeling very proud of my Mexican heritage, because the outside influence was that Mexicans were dirty and untrustworthy and all the other things that I know you've all heard about Mexicans. So I grew up hearing those too. And you know, I grew up as an only child, which was also very unique. So I was a daughter of an immigrant and only child. And there was a lot of times I felt lonely. And there was a lot of times where my mom could only do so much, you know, because she's trying to support us. And so there were times in my life where I felt outside presence, outside, not just the spirit, but other people.
Nope, that's not it.
That's not the thing. But
I'll find it.
You want me to talk about this one?
No, I keep going about ancestors. I'll find it.
So there were times when I felt an outside presence, more than just the spirit, but like someone else was in the room with me. And that happened many times throughout my childhood, but it happened in times when I was maybe in danger, and I felt a certain protection. And the older I got, I look back on those experiences, and I am now able to see who was there. At first, you know, I was like, I wasn't sure who was there. And then in my teens, I was like, oh, it was angels. And then I realized, oh, the angels were my family. And more specifically, not just my family, they were my mothers, my ancestresses.
There it is.
Watched over me during those very hard, scary times in my life. They protected me from a lot of things that I probably should have experienced but did not, because they were a barrier, a protection, and a guidance to me. So this is ancestresses, meaning Nies, which is, Nies is like my childhood. So this is number one, and then I have, like I said, two more in the trio. But it also is a very interesting painting because as a person of mixed ancestry, not all my ancestors look like me. And I think we're not used to thinking or talking about that. You think, oh, all your ancestors look just like you. No, I have such a mixed ancestry, and I'm proud of all of them, and I feel connected to all of them. And, you know, because of white supremacy, many people of color are taught to only celebrate or talk about their white ancestors, their European ancestors. And I wanted to break that pattern and be like, I embrace all of my ancestry, especially my ancestors that were pushed into the shadows. I really wanted to pull them out of the shadows and push them into the light and connect them to me through the ribbons, and so that they cannot be separated from me. You cannot take them from me, and you cannot take that part of my heritage, my family history, away from me again.
You know, Michelle, there's so many things I love about this painting. In fact, we had a conversation earlier about whether this painting were available or not, and she said that I had to wait. But anyway, one of the things I love about this is you use a certain style of perspective that causes a viewer and causes us, first of all, we're right there, frank with you in this space, with you. You invite us in a very frank way. The perspective is such that that those in the back feel like they're closer to us in the front, in this folk style of sort of a flat perspective. But one of the things I love that you did, and I'll tell you, I'll confess, I was uncomfortable the first time I saw this painting. And I had to, for an instant, and I realized it was because you had swapped it, where the European ancestors were in a Mexican landscape. And I loved that you put them where you needed them, inside of you again. So thank you for making this painting. Tell them a little bit about the work that you do with genealogy. You talk so much about the power of genealogy. Would you talk about that for a second? And Margaret, feel free to jump in at any time. You
enjoying
it's wonderful, isn't it?
Yes.
One of the biggest things that I talk about with family history, well, family history is anti-racism work, especially for people of color, because people of color have to be able to talk about race when we do our family history. We have to have racial literacy and racial stamina. We can't just pretend certain things didn't happen, especially for Latinos. We have to talk about colonization, and enslavement. There was a huge slave trade to Latin America. But it's really hard because there's a certain shame about saying you're connected to indigenous and African people, even now within the community. And there's a lot of talk and research coming out about how shame is so damaging, how internalized racism is so damaging, and many Latinos carry that within us. And me connecting to my family history and learning about anti-racism work, being able to name the things that happened to my ancestors, being able to name, put a word to the things, the generational trauma I was feeling, was so empowering, and within my art as well, to be able to tell that story and to work out my feelings about my European ancestors and my indigenous ancestors and my African ancestors. Like how do all these people who quote unquote hate each other and abuse each other and traumatize each other, how did they all come together to fit in one person, and how do I process that?
I'm seeing a lot of head nods. Kalani, does this resonate? your mother's Danish, isn't she?
My mom's family's Swedish.
Swedish. We're all three Swedish.
Yeah.
Look at us. We're the three Swedish girls.
Yeah, no, I... that definitely resonates with me. I feel like, especially within the Mormon context, there was a lot that I had to work out. I remember, I've said this before, but I remember sitting in a young woman's lesson, and being told that, you know, we're supposed to marry within our own race, and feeling like, so I can never get married because whoever I marry is going to be marrying somebody that's outside of their race, because just because who I am is outside of your race, you know, because I'm more than one person, more than and so I
just
think,
so you know, Kalani, I got that same talk as well.
Yeah. And like, I think it was a common understanding, you know, and it was something that was not meant to be hurtful, you know, and I don't think that the young woman's leader who said it thought twice about men. But it's interesting because, you know, I don't feel like I look white, but I don't feel like there was a lot of time in my church life where I was seen as different. I just felt different. You know, I can think of so many instances where people would talk about things, not even thinking that the things that they were saying would be offensive to me, because they didn't understand that, you know, the things that you're talking about negatively, that's me, you know? And like, when you talk about Lamanites and you talk about, you know, whatever it is, that you're framing things in a way that is hurtful to me, but they don't see it at all, you know? And that was really an interesting thing to have to work through as I got older and realize, oh, that's who you see me as. That's not who I am. And it's okay for me to understand that. And it's interesting that you don't even see that that's who you see me at. You know what I mean? Like just little things like that. But yeah, I totally, I can relate to a lot of the just conflicting emotions that come with being biracial.
You know, and it's interesting because Marlena, when I started with the, but all that has changed, I heard that for the first time and I'm like, I just got chills just thinking of it. I was like, she got the fascinating womanhood lesson just like I did. I saw Margaret nodding and nodding during that piece because that's so universal. And I thought, but wait, Marlena could be a model. You know, like, and I was like, I can't believe it caused me to rethink. But Kalani, one thing you do artistically that's similar to Michelle is you take this Swedish horse, this red horse, and you put it within the pattern of Polynesia. And so there again, you're using and layering in that symbolism. And Mike, can you move to that next slide? I don't know if we have these up. I picked a couple for you, a painting that I love.
Just tell me the name of the painting. I'll get it.
Can I say something, something I think really important that Kalani said was, she's like, you know, you don't see me as I see me. And I think that is so important in having artists of color tell their own stories. We have so much art, and I think we're going to have more art painted by white artists of people of color, but it's not the same because you see us differently. Like the Springville Art Museum has a beautiful collection of indigenous art. But most of the art is
amazing.
Painted through the European white lens. It's not painted by native people. And that's why Kalani's work is so, like, I get emotional every time I see her work because I can feel, like she said, the spirit of authenticity and her family and her pride in who she is. It's not just something beautiful and exotic that a white artist thought looked worth capturing. It's part of her soul. And so I do worry that as time goes on, a lot of white artists are going to be painting people of color. And I'm worried they're going to have shows filled with people of color. And yet the majority of the artists are going to be white. And they're going to say, this is diverse. Look how inclusive we are. And you're like, wait, what? And I don't know what to do to fix, like to make a note of that. I don't know.
Well, we keep painting, but it's interesting because I've gotten into arguments about with white men about discussions over a certain Liz Levin Swindle painting of Christ holding a small African boy. And me going, oh, ouch. And white men going, but wait, Andy, this is great art. And you know, and I, it is a battle that pain is real and the suffering is going to be one that we have to suffer together. And that's one of the reasons why where one of us go, we all go. Did those slides come up? Because if not, we'll just move on to why I chose.
Just give me a title.
It is the sea waves. It's marked number 2 on the Kalani slide. Kalani Sea Waves, the seaside.
I have to find it.
That's okay. Let's move on to patterns with Marlena's patterns. They were all in a Dropbox folder with just these 5, but that's all right. We'll see them at the end.
Okay.
If we can find patterns, this is something that is really interesting to me. And Marlena was the first one to really challenge me with this word patterns. And I want to show this image if we can find it. But do you want to talk about this time, Marlena, when you're painting this one and also the other one, Untitled? And where were you and what were you going through and what were you kind of learning and discovering?
Yeah, can you guys hear me? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I also wanted to say, I'm 15% European, so I just thought I should say that. You know, I'm not really allowed to claim that. So, and I just appreciated what was said earlier, but yeah, I am 15%. So, my grandmother, was half, and my other grandmother was also, had a lot of European blood as well.
Interesting.
So with, patterns, you know, I created this work when I was, like I said earlier, I was only Black student in the whole art department. And at this time I was in Britain learning about the slave trade. And what kind of prompted me to create this work is, you know, I realized like when I wanted to create, like I'm really into symbolism. So, you know, as you can probably see that these are bodies, these are the bodies that were laid in the slave boats, and I actually intentionally printed on cargo paper, that's what they called it in the UK, and I named this patterns because, I mean, as you see, it's a pattern, and I didn't want to give too much away because, you know, from far away, it looks like a pattern, it's, you know, it might look like a pretty pattern. But as you get closer, you start to see that it's not as pretty as you might think. Yeah. And I think that's kind of history. You know, history tends to repeat itself as a pattern. And that's why I called it patterns. And unfortunately, especially in the United States, when it comes to general education and what is taught in history, people aren't really taught the accurate history. They're taught the pretty stuff, the nice stuff. And so because of that, I believe that patterns tend to repeat itself when people don't know what's going on. They might not look the same, but it is basically of the same seed, you know, distinguished in maybe a different form. And that's what I keep seeing, you know, and it's not just, you know, this particular image is kind of linked to me when it comes to African-Americans and slavery, but it also comes to other people who were, you know, I even think of I have Native American heritage as well. I even think of that as well, where that's another thing that people don't know what really happened and the patterns tend to repeat. So that's when it comes to patterns. And then do you want me to talk about Untitled?
Yes, please do. This is such an important story. And Margaret, this is one where I saw your head nodding, but this, and how long did it take me to cue in to what you were saying when you talked about this?
Pretty fast.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So I made this piece Untitled, and a lot of
we will show Untitled quite a bit towards the end of this, so just keep this in mind, and also another piece that relates to patterns, so go ahead.
So a lot of this work actually that you've seen, I made this in 2014 when I was in the, you know, an art student, and it didn't surface until now because of my experience at BYU being the only Black student. I was known as like the sweet child, but I think at the same time, I kind of had the persona to be safe. And so I think people were really surprised with my artwork because it wasn't necessarily always so like sweet and not in your face. And so I've had experiences where I made this piece called Untitled again, when I was in Britain, and I was with among a group, and I was really grateful. I just was so happy about this piece because it really, I felt, portrayed how I felt, how my brothers felt, how a lot of Black people feel. And I presented this in a group of other students, and I was kind of reprimanded for it. In fact, like, the way I've explained it, I've been a little bit too, you know, I haven't been as upfront how it actually was. I mean, I cried. That was the experience I had. And I only had one other student who stood up for me, and he was from Canada.
Wow.
And I didn't really get a good score in that piece. So I actually just recently found that piece in a box, like 3 months ago. And
That's not it.
I think I was actually going to throw it away. I just didn't. And so that's kind of where I said earlier, I don't have a lot of works and I didn't get my BFA, even though I've always wanted to be an artist, because I just didn't think I was good enough. And I mean, everyone has opinion of you. And so I don't blame my professor.
Nope, that's not it.
For him, for sure. But it just made me realize, like, one, you know, how important my voice is, and two, you know, not everyone's going to understand your work, and that's okay. Right. And your work is not for everyone, but that doesn't mean it's not important. And so, you know, yeah, so that, yeah, this is the piece that I made, and the response has been crazy. I mean, I've been, like, I was almost afraid to share this piece, and I'm grateful because it's given me, you know, more confidence in the things that I want to share, because a lot of my work kind of has, you know, some of this, you know, feeling. And I do realize too that I also kind of made my work symbolic in a way in the past, because I was also, I also felt like I couldn't always put in your face stuff, because this one was a little bit more in your face than Patterns was. And I think maybe that made me feel like, okay, I can't really do stuff like this. I have to do something that's a little bit more toned down. That, yeah. So anyway.
Well, Margaret, I see you nodding your head. Would you hang on to those thoughts? Because I want to run through the other artists quickly and come back to what it is that women like me and you and others can do to make sure that these sorts of experiences don't happen in the future. Kwani, I want to move over to you. And Mike, I don't know. Kwani, what's the title of the Jingle Dance painting from behind?
I've done two of them.
The one of them was from the waist up from behind that shows the pattern that is on the cape that comes around.
It's either Stillness or Serenity.
Stillness.
I've painted both of them. I've painted it just one slightly angled different from another.
And let me talk to you while Mike finds that. It's the Kwani Stillness is the one I'm looking for. And I want to talk to you first about Kwani. I'm a super fan. Like, I'm so, and I just want to know, are you outside painting right now?
Yeah.
I knew it! She's making art! She's making art! No, honestly, oh my gosh. While the rest of us have been, like, watching TV, Kwani is making gorgeous art. And let me tell you, you can lay the paint down. Like, it is otherworldly. And I wish I had more of your landscapes and others, because you are such an amazing painter. And
thank you.
Well, and it's not sentimental, but it's not super Western-y. I mean, it's very feminine and strong. One of the things I like about this jingle dance, you talked about patterns, you talked about how these patterns were on your pottery. You want to talk a little bit about what patterns mean in your culture? And maybe we can find that painting.
So this is actually, that was the first painting that I really put out there that was not from from family. And so it was the first time I had painted a different native.
I noticed that. And the Hopi women too are beautiful.
Yeah. So they're kind of like cousins. We dress the same. We have a lot of the same things, but like, and I actually grew up around jingle dancers. I grew up by the Fort Hall Reservation, just a mile away from it. And it was interesting being a Southwest Native growing up next to a different culture that was also Native American.
Right.
And seeing that culture through white eyes,
oh,
I guess. But then seeing and knowing what it was like from the Native side. I don't know. I got a little taste of how the world sees Native Native people. Anyways,
which means
this painting.
Which means what? Go ahead.
Well, they.
And then I'm going to say why this, right now at this time, that jingle dance painting is so important. We can talk about that in just a bit. But what is it to see Native?
It was not a good perception of the Shoshone Bannock tribe and tribal lands. They were seen as disruptive, as hooligans, a little bit of uneducated, and the culture around it was in where I grew up. And internalizing those biases a little bit and realizing that there were times that I would say, oh yeah, I'm Native American, but I'm not from.
Yeah, well, and we need to explain that you are Pueblo, and each one of these are nations, right? We're talking about nations. So you're from the and the Pueblo Nation is all the way down in New Mexico and Taos area. And then you're with the Shoshone Bannocks, which is mid-Idaho, isn't it?
Yeah, totally different lifestyles. They were different cultures. Like, it's like a different language. I tell people that. It's like you go over to Europe and you try and say, like, oh, all Europeans are the same.
Yeah. And particularly with Pueblo, because they weren't displaced. So.
Yeah, they weren't. So we had our reservations drawn around where we always lived. And so we had the privilege of keeping a lot of our history, even though it was oral history and a lot of that has been lost. I would say a lot more has been preserved than a lot of these other displaced tribes that were, you know, kind of gathered and here you go. But it was nerve-wracking for me to paint stillness because I just, she was in there's an art show I do every August. That's a Native American art show, and you have to be a Native American blood. You have to be part of a registered tribe to participate, and you have to adhere to strict guidelines of how you create your art. And they have a clothing competition, traditional Native clothing competition, and she was there, and I took this picture, and I just had to paint it because it was, I don't know, it's just the way she held herself and the way she was, and I didn't know her at the time. I know her now, and I've painted her a few times. But that was the first time that I really tried to capture someone else and try to capture what I saw and paint, not necessarily her clothing. It's interesting because it's from the back, but it's about her.
it's the painting of a woman from behind, if you can find that. But I'll tell you two things that were interesting to me. Number one, do you want to talk about how the jingle dance came about? Not that one. Nope. That one. Go back.
Get there.
One more. There.
There we go.
There it is. Yay. No. Go.
There you go. Okay.
Explain where jingle dance came from, and I could be wrong, but I think, wasn't it during the 1918 flu pandemic?
See, I don't even know. True. I know that they have been dancing. I don't know when the bells got added. They've always danced with shells the elk teeth that you see on her dress, but the bells, yes, definitely are a more recent addition.
The bells actually came about from the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic, and they wanted to dance but not go into the same space as those that had the flu. And so they would dance right outside of the room or the house with bells on to let them know that they were doing these healing dances. Isn't that amazing? And so when I saw this painting by you, again, chills, and I saw the bells, and I was just like, you know, people are dancing for us. And we can hear them and can see them, but we just can't be in the same room with them. So this painting has a really important, special place for me during this time of isolation, because I just think of that story and that experience. The other thing I love is you talked about how patterns for you are your pottery and your vessels. And I saw this painting and I see the patterns of the shells. And I thought what Pawnee has done is shown woman as a vessel. As this vessel that has life and has heart and soul. And as we began with that piece about being a woman, I think that there again, each one of you in your feminine, in the way you depict the feminine divine, really challenge this cisgender male European view of what women are supposed to be, you know, push the button on the copier. So I really want to thank you for that. I want to move on really quickly so we can have time for Q&A to Esther. And if we can find the painting of Esther's, that's the triptych. That's the one I wondered if I could get Esther to talk about a little bit. And Esther, talk a little bit just maybe about your feelings of symbolism and pattern, but also about culture and pulling culture together in your life.
Yeah. So I'll start by talking about the piece specifically.
Yeah.
So that this piece was one that I painted while I was doing a residency at the New York Academy of Art. And it was my first time really living away from home, like as someone, not as a missionary. So like I started a mission and went away from home, but it's, you know, that's a whole different thing. And it really brought into focus what my identity was, where I fit into the world, because I feel like when you grow up in the same little town and you're around your family all the time, you kind of have this safe space to go back to and this kind of place to plug back into and understand how you fit in with something. But when you're completely alone, in a sense, in a huge city like New York, interacting with lots of people, different people from around the world and from around the country, it really makes you ask questions. And it also made me ask a lot of questions about my spirituality and religiosity and how I saw myself living that going forward. Because I grew up in a more conservative LDS family, you know, on the spectrum of what LDS living looks like, and kind of, you know, this is the way to do the gospel. And being away from that and interacting with a lot of the really wonderful, like, academic young single adults in New York City, it made me question a lot of those things. And, you know, I was also kind of at that phase of life where I was trying to figure out, you know, where I stood on a lot of things and making mistakes and then feeling really guilty about those mistakes and, you know, trying to wrap my head around these concepts of, like, the balance between loss of innocence and the gaining of knowledge. And I think that's something that's central to the doctrines of our church, is this, you know, the interplay of knowledge and innocence. And so there's just so many things that come to play in this piece. And that's what I love about symbolism, is that you look at it and it seems pretty simple. Hopefully Michael can get it pulled up really quickly, but it's a little triptych and it has one square with cherries and then it has a self-portrait of myself. Oh, there you go. Perfect. And yeah, like the casual viewer can look at this and be like, you know, the colors work great, you know, a paint application is fun, whatever you want to say about it on a surface level. But to someone that I'm willing to open up to, I can give them this context and I can give them kind of a peek into my soul and into my life and into those conflicts that I was trying to grapple with at that crossroads that I was experiencing. And Marlena said this in her video interview, and I absolutely loved it. And she said that it's almost a way of protecting some of these very vulnerable aspects of yourself and your experience. And I think you see reflections of that in the gospel as well, that, you know, Christ talks about how he teaches in parables so that those who aren't ready to learn don't learn. And I feel like I do that through my art as well, is that if people are ready to engage with these hard topics, then I can open their eyes to them. And if they're not, they can look at it and be like, I like the colors. So
it matches my sofa.
Yeah.
Hey, let me just jump in here really quick.
Yeah.
We've got about 10 minutes left. I know we haven't heard from Margaret, but I also know you wanted to hear, to open it up for questions.
I think so. Anyway. And Margaret, can we come back to you in the Q&A section?
Well, this is the Q&A because we've only got 10 minutes left.
Okay. Well, I want to finish with an announcement. We've decided actually that, I want to create a patterns of diversity award annually, and to award it to somebody annually. I'd like to eventually do it on behalf of Dialogue, but I have to ask my board tomorrow. Sometimes I do things and then ask permission. And this year there's a piece that I really love, and it's going to be on the cover of Dialogue. All of you will be featured in Dialogue, by the way. In the spring 2021. And I want to award this cash award for $150 to Marlena Wilding. Because Marlena, guess what? You're a professional artist. Your art is good. It's good art and it's important art. And if this can create a little bit of headspace for you to create more art, then I would be just really, really pleased. Our world will be better with your voice in it. and we love you. So this piece, Marlena, I kind of combined two pieces because, you know, Swept Under the Rug is a sound piece that I love, and this is short. And so I created two pieces. And the last, of course, on the end is your piece, Patterns of America Sew. And I think we'll just let this roll so we can go right into questions. Go ahead, Mike.
Hopefully. Oh, while Mike's pulling it up, I want to say it's really interesting that out of the five artists here, three of us are mixed race, but we define our experience by our minority experience. And I think that has a lot to say about how race is perceived in the United States. That even though half of my experience is white, that has not been necessarily the defining experience of my life.
I think that's super important. You guys, thank you so much. I've had a great time. If we can't pull that up, we'll pull it up at the end of the Q&A. How's that? Are we close?
We're close.
It's coming. It's a good piece. It's one you have to sit with just a little bit, and it's tough. This piece will appear with Dr. Fatima Saleh this next week at Faith Again, as she presents on the intersection of social justice and faith. And if you listen closely, there is an LDS aspect to this that I think is really interesting that gives this other layer of complexity. Go ahead.
1 minute.
We don't have a minute. Special thank you to Michael Austin for making all of this happen. And Esther especially. Took a year off Esther's life to create that. There it is.
Ancient ritual takes place.
There it is.
Takes place here.
Yeah, so let's go ahead and open it up. My first question is, Margaret, can you tell us about your movie and how you, just any other thoughts that you have?
People find out about my movie elsewhere. I want to focus on these amazing women and just say that I consider that my main job, as I do whatever I do in writing plays, writing screenplays, is to open a space so that the stories can be told, and preferably from the people who have lived the stories. With our film, we had them film it in the Congo, and we had them put it in their own language and direct and all of that. Of all of these women, I've heard of Kalani. I've been impressed by her writings. I've known Marlena for years and absolutely adore her. I've been stunned by her art. The masked man, the one we just saw, has had particular significance for me. And her experience at BYU breaks my heart. But it also calls us all to responsibility to be sure that Marlena's voice and other voices like hers are honored and given the opportunity to be heard. With everything, I met Michelle in New York. I love her piece, Resurrection Morning. That's one that has drawn me over and over and over. I've taken my granddaughter to see that one at Written Vision. The others, I don't know, but I have loved the art. I've loved being a part of this, and I just want to hear what everybody else has to say.
All right, well, we're out of time, but the last question that we have here is, what can institutions do or do better to support artists of color? So I'll throw that to whoever wants to answer it.
Rick, I'll just mention, Grace mentioned we could go over a bit. So if there's a couple questions, she said that we could go.
That's the only question I have on here.
Okay, great.
So.
Okay, that sounds great. What do you guys think? Well, what I wish, go ahead, you got answer, who has an answer to that?
So the question is, what can institutions do or do better to support artists of color?
For me, it's scholarships. There is a big financial barrier to pursuing art. It's seen as less than. Especially, I grew up in a very utilitarian farmer community, and you're not working with your hands, so therefore what you're doing isn't worthwhile. And now they all rally around me, but like when I was going into school, and especially when I switched from a medical field to art, it was just like, what are you doing with your life? You're throwing away your life, is kind of. So making that valid. Providing opportunities through scholarship, and then also seeking out. I mean, I wouldn't be alone in saying that there's a lot of people that pursue art in high school that don't go on to do it in any professional capacity. And there's ways to, you know, visit local, you know, if you know, university, even just visiting local high school art shows and things and awarding scholarships to even just attend, I guess. I had a unique story of how I got into art and how I was even able to take art classes, but just having those opportunities, I guess.
I think something from the academic perspective is making sure that college programs are geared towards professional success. And by that, I mean that they are training you on both the business and the practical side, not just the skills and the conceptual side. And that's something that I saw as a gaping hole in my education, but I was lucky enough to have mentors and a father who's an entrepreneur and other people in my life. I can kind of see those patterns and apply them for myself. But I've seen how, especially for, you know, kind of like Kwani was saying, people of color that are coming from communities that are not supportive of the arts to start with, they are left high and dry. So they might get a BA, they might get a BFA, but then they have no idea how to actually turn that into a profession. And so I think as professors, that's something like I've tried to do as a professor and tried to encourage my colleagues to do as well, just really making sure that the skills are applicable. And then within the professional world, whatever that looks like for other people.
Something I would say is that we need to work towards redefining what fine art and culture and folk art are, because a lot of times, you know, I know that I work for a nonprofit that helps specifically Pacific Islanders, but you know, anybody that really wants to join can join. But we help find resources. And one of the barriers that we run into a lot is that they don't allow us to even apply for grants because they see our work as folk art and not fine art. Or they see, like, we have elders that teach these amazing artistic things that they're not valid because they don't have a PhD or they don't fall into a specific category of art. And so I think broadening that definition to include artists that are atypical would be really beneficial to artists of color.
I also wanted to say too, I think also what I think picking back on what you were saying, because I agree, also like what is art, because I feel like, you know, even with my sound pieces, you know, or just I think, how should I say this? I think it's important to kind of redefine what is art, just kind of what you're saying with folk art, because I think another great thing that people can do is just be open to all the creations that people make and to sit with it before dismissing it, whether it's good or bad, because, you know, I think with some of the reactions that I've gotten sometimes is that people have felt uncomfortable sometimes when they see my work, but to maybe sit with it and figure out why, and then be like, okay, like now I haven't seen that before and I'm open to it now. Because I think the thing is there's a lot of people who are making art who are of color, but oftentimes their work is being dismissed as not as good because of what you typically see from artists. And that's where you don't get to diversify. You don't see a lot of different things if you're continuing to look for a certain clean, you know, palette, if that makes sense. So I think that's also important because there are a lot of people who are making work. It's just maybe being more open to what you define as artwork.
Michelle, you want to add on?
The artists that a lot of artists of color are not going to be refined and polished. They need help. They need mentors. So there's people out there who are super creative and are, you know, doing the best. They just will pretty much piggybacking on what everyone said here. Like for recent immigrants, you know, if they're going to even send their kids to college, that is a huge sacrifice. And they want someone that's a lawyer or a doctor or whatever, that's going to make money. And they will have zero family support to go into the arts and to get a degree. So either you have the people that are just going to go it alone and try to do it to get their degree, or, you know, people like me who are just have to find a way to teach yourself. And then, I mean, trying to get supplies was insane. I still to this day don't even know how I was able to get brushes and paints, because it was nearly impossible. So I think finding the unpolished, you know, and helping them, because Kirk's done that for me. Yeah. Like he really helped me, and it's all through social media. So the artists are out there. We just need to go find them. And I love Kwani's idea of going to the high school show. I know when Springville did their high school show, there were artists of color there, and some of them were amazing. And I'm like, I hope whoever is around these kids are mentoring them and helping them. So even if their parents are like, there's no way we will pay for you to go to college to study art, there's other people in their lives, teachers, whatever, that are like, I follow you on Instagram and I will support you to go do this on art. And I think that's where social media is so powerful to help the next wave of artists of color within the church.
I'm going to tack on also that we are here at a scholarly symposium, and we as artists make art so that we don't have to write in words. Kalani has an amazing grasp of both, I think Michelle as well, but most of us don't write. You guys do. And scholarship needs to be putting a lens on the complexity, the sophistication of traditional and atypical art. And once it has a defining thing, like our job is to, as scholars, is to teach people how to see, how to perceive something. So here is this deep dive of material, of feminism, of issues of race and culture, of what is academic, what is not academic, and no one has touched it. I mean, that is a call to action on from the side of scholarship. I am asking scholarship to do a deep dive into these the images and the work that has been done, the work that Margaret has done. It's complex, it's nuanced, and unless we put words to it, other people won't be able to see it. You guys.
All right, well, we're way over time.
Let's hang out again sometime.
Yeah, I would just encourage everybody that you can continue this discussion on the community chat boards.
Okay.
And thank you all for being on this awesome session.
Thank you, Rick. Mm-hmm.